course.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman. And good to see so many of you. We are going to tackle one of the more challenging books in Tanakh this morning or this evening, Sefer Daniel. I'm going to divide our time together into three sections. We're going to start by talking about the first parak of the book. Then we're going to talk about the first half of the book as a unit that contains a bunch of stories, many of which are very well-known stories. And then the last part, we'll be talking about the second half of the book, which contains visions, some of which are well-known, at least in part, and have been very influential, but are certainly less well-known than the stories and are a bit stranger and therefore harder to tackle. What I'd like to do in terms of our dynamic is that I would like to, if it's okay, Rabbi Kelman, I'd like to take each of these sections, about 20 minutes or so on each section, and then pause for questions, comments on that section, and then move on to the next one. That way, you know, in an hour and 5 minutes, we don't have to try to figure out what the question referred to from the first section. So hopefully it'll be essentially three short presentations followed by your questions and comments on that presentation. Okay, so I hope everyone sees the, are we coming? You see the front page of the PowerPoint, right?
Okay. You do, yes.
Fantastic. Okay, so the first thing that I want to talk about with Book of Daniel is that it is a book of Galut. It's a book of diaspora. And this is, in fact, very important in the book. And it's, in fact, explicit in setting up the book. So the very first parak of the Sefer begins with a little historical background. It starts Bishnat Shalosh L'Malchut Yoyakim Melech Yehuda Ban Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel Yerushalayim Vayatzar Aleha. So it takes us back to Yerushalayim, to Yehuda, back before the exile, and it tells us about how the Jews got into exile. And it tells us a very, very brief sort of thumbnail sketch of how this happened. He brought Yoyakim into exile. The dating is actually different than what we have in Sefer Melachim, but I won't worry about that right now. And Nebuchadnezzar brought much of the gold and the people, of course, to Bavel, to what's called here Eretz Shinar, and deposited the gold into his treasury. And then, more important for setting up our story, the king orders Ashpenaz, his chief officer, Rav Sarisav, to bring some of Bnei Israel, Mi Bnei Israel, Mi Zera HaMelucha, Min HaPartamim, and he's going to raise these children in the palace. So he wants to raise some of these Jewish children, these Judean kids, as it says at the end of the fourth pasuk, La'amor Be'echal HaMelech, U'lamdam Sefer U'lishon Kastim, teach them the writings and the language of the Chaldeans, in other words, of the Babylonians. So some of the young Judeans are going to be raised in the palace, in Babylonian culture, Babylonian education, they're going to be intellectuals. And as it turns out, this includes four people who are going to be the stars of the show for the next few prakim. That's Daniel himself, and three of his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So before we get into that, I want to actually take each of the units of this parak and just think together about this parak as sort of setting the stage for the major themes of the book. So this is actually very important. The fact that the book opens with this little historical prologue and says, Nebuchadnezzar attacked Yerushalayim, Nebuchadnezzar brought the Jews to Bavel, that actually should not be taken for granted. When you compare it, for example, to Megillat Esther, Megillat Esther starts in the middle of things. You have Achashverosh, it's the third year of Achashverosh, he made a party. Why are we in Shushan at the time? Like, why are we, the Jews, looking at the story in Shushan? Why are we interested in this? How do the Jews get there? So that we don't hear at all. Of course, later in the middle of Perek Bet, we do hear about Mordechai and his exilic story, his story of how he got there. But the question of how the Jews got to exile is never mentioned in Megillat Esther. And certainly that's not the way the book opens. The Book of Esther opens like, we just live here. Like, this is just the diaspora. It's the reality that we grapple with. And the Book of Daniel takes us through a little bit of a narrative to explain how we got there. And that, I think, literarily is an important point because it makes the point from the beginning that this is not the way that things ought to be. This is exile. Daniel is being brought up in the palace of the Babylonians, but this is not l'chadchila, this is not the way things are supposed to be. He should have been, of course, in Yehuda and Yerushalayim, but Nebuchadnezzar exiled people. In Esther, we don't get that sense. In Esther, we get the sense that people are live in Paras and Madai, and that's just the way things are. And in fact, at the end of the book, that's just the way things will continue to be. The third great book of diaspora, of Galut, from Bayit Sheni in Tanakh, is Ezra and Nehemiah. So these three books really, you know, I'm sure you've already thought about them together to some extent as you studied the others. But Ezra and Nehemiah, of course, does open in Galut. The characters Ezra and Nehemiah are natives of the Gola, natives of the Eastern diaspora, but both of them actually move back to the land of Israel. So that, of course, is different from Esther, who stays in Shushan for the rest of her life. It's also different from Daniel. Daniel, even though he's introduced as an exilic Jew here at the beginning, he never moves back to Israel. There's no happy ending where the Galut ends. There are happy endings to many of the stories, and we'll talk more about those in a few minutes. But if we want to contrast these books in terms of their scopes of where people live, where people ought to live, Esther begins and ends in Galut. Daniel begins in Yerushalayim, quickly gets to Galut, and then stays in Galut. Ezra and Nehemiah begin in Galut, then move back to the land of Israel. Both of them move back to Yerushalayim. All right, so that's the first thing that we notice about this story, is that it starts with an introduction for how they got to the Galut. Now, these youths, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, who you meet here in the middle of the slide that you have in front of you, they're among the youths who are raised in the palace. They get food. They get educated for 3 years. And the last line here on the slide, Vayasam lehem sar hasarisim, let me just move this away. Shemot. Vayasam Daniel belt shatzar l'chanina shadrach l'mishael meshach v'l'azariah aved nego. So the four youths each get new names. We're not told that they argued about these names. They don't resist. They don't say, like, how dare you rename me? But, of course, naming and renaming is an important theme in Tanakh and elsewhere. Elsewhere in Tanakh, in Chumash, we think about the story of Gan Eden. The first thing that Adam is asked to do with the new creatures is to see what he'll name the creatures. But more relevantly, we think of stories like Paro renaming Yosef. There are various pharaohs later on in Malachim who rename Judean kings who they've put on the throne. Babylonian kings who rename kings whom they've put on the throne. Renaming is an act of power. If I can give you a name, it means that I assert power over your identity. I decide who you really are. And when the Rav Sarisim, gives Daniel a new name, he's now Belshazzar, he's essentially asserting, you're no longer Daniel. It's true, that's your origin. It's true, that's where you were born. But now you're Belshazzar. We've re-educated you, literally, right? You're not raised anymore in the Beit Midrash, in the Beit Sefer in Yerushalayim. You're not spending your day learning Torah Kohanim. You're spending your day learning Sefer HaKasdim, Lashon HaKasdim. You're learning Babylonian wisdom and Babylonian texts. And part of that re-education and re-identification is that they have new names. Of course, since I've already mentioned these people, Esther also has another name. Esther's native name, presumably, was Hadassah. That's her Hebrew name. Esther is a good Persian Babylonian name. In the case of Esther, it's interesting because Hadassah never shows up again. We're told that she has a name Hadassah, but she's never called Hadassah. She's only called Esther the entire book. It seems actually that the only reason we're told that her name was Hadassah is that we should appreciate that she's never called Hadassah. To some extent, her true identity, her Hadassah identity, is never allowed to emerge. Daniel is actually more complicated. He's called Belshazzar a number of times over the course of the book. And I think it's fair to say that that is importantly symbolic in terms of his identity. One of the major tensions, but a productive tension in this book, is that he is going to forever be both Daniel and Belshazzar. He's going to wear both of those hats successfully over the course of the coming stories. So externally, he cooperates, his friends cooperate. They walk around from now on in the palace. They say, hey, hi, my name is Belshazzar. My name is Shadrach. My name is Meshach. My name is Avednego. they don't resist this renaming. They don't resist this re-education. At the same time, that's naming is, at the end of the day, only externalities, right? We all know that names are labels. They're useful. It might be an important statement of re-education, identification, and even power and control. But someone renaming someone else can't actually change their identity. And as we read on in the story, still in Perek Aleph, it turns out that although Daniel has accepted this name Belshazzar, he has not accepted a new identity altogether. So this is the only tension in this story in Perek Aleph, is that Daniel, Vayasem Daniel al libo, asher lo yitga'al b'fatbag hamelech v'yein mishtav, v'yivakesh misar asarisim asher lo yitga'al. He decided he was not going to eat the king's food or the wine that the king drank. And so he asked permission of the chief officer not to defile himself. Yitga'al is the word that's used here. Now, of course, this may be, to some extent, a halachic issue. But as it turns out, it's not just a halachic issue. It's more of a cultural resistance issue. Of course, Yayin has a whole suite of halachic issues. But when we see what they actually got, the Sarasari Sim says, look, and I'm concerned. My job is to raise you, to educate you, to make sure that you're healthy body and mind. And if I don't give you the food or the wine, you're going to wither up and die. So Daniel says, listen, here's the idea. Daniel, Hanani, Mishan, and Azaria say, Nasna et avadecha yamim asara, v'yitznu lanu min hazeroim v'nuchla umayim v'nishte. Just give us essentially legumes or anything vegan. Zeroim, obviously from the word zera, although a form of that word. And then v'yeru lefanecha mar'enu, mar'e ha'yiladim ha'ochlim et patbag ha'melech, v'chasher tas'tir'eh, asayim avadecha. So 10 days, let us eat this vegan diet and drink only water, and check how we look in 10 days. If we look as good as the other youths being raised on the royal diet, then we pass the test. We should be allowed to do this. So before we see how the test works out, I think this is really important as a reaction to the renaming in the previous paragraph. So Daniel, Hanani, Mishael, and Azaria allow themselves to be renamed, but they won't allow their insides to be defiled by what the king provides. As there is a sense, and I want you to notice the names here. Vayasem Daniel alibo. Vayomer Daniel al Daniel, Hanani, Mishael, and Azaria. In other words, just two lines after they were renamed, Belshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Daniel, Hanana, Mishael, and Azariah resist. And they say, look, you know, we're accepting the education, we're accepting the renaming, all this is fine, we're being raised in the palace here. But there's a point beyond which we won't cross. There's a point beyond which we actually think we're being defiled by the king's food and drink. And we would like to remain essentially natural. In other words, I don't think this is primarily about halacha of Bishul Akum or Yayin Nesach or Stam Yenam. This is primarily about things that are cooked in the royal kitchen are symbolic of we are ingesting, literally, things that come from the Babylonian kitchen, and we would rather have things from the natural world. We'd rather have Zeroim and Mayim. That's what we'd prefer to have. Just give us a vegan diet and water, and we'll work on our insides on our own. So that's I think, the third theme of this perek, and a balance between, on the one hand, there's external cooperation, but balance with internal resistance. Now, how does the story wind up? So, not surprisingly, they eat this vegan diet, they drink the water for 10 days, and they look great. In fact, umiktzat yamim asara, nir'am arayhem tov uvrei basar min kol yiladim ha'ochlim et pat v'agamelch. They look even better and healthier than all of these who are eating the king's food. So the test succeeds wildly, and this internal resistance turns out to be successful. And this is going to be something that's going to accompany the youths throughout, they're not going to be youths anymore, but the characters throughout the next bunch of stories. They will resist the foreign rule when they feel like they have to. And it's when it is an affront to something that they feel is incredibly profoundly significant in terms of their own Jewish identity. They're loyal Babylonians most of the time, but there's a point at which they say, no, here we have to resist. And when they do that, it works out very well. And so they get their vegan diet for the rest of the time there. V'yaladim ha'ela arba'atam natan lahem Elohim mada v'haskel b'chol sefer v'chokma v'daniel hevin b'chol chazon v'chalamot. So as a result of their, I should say implicitly, as a result of their act of faith in their resistance to the Babylonian culture, God's never been mentioned now, but God steps in and says, excellent, I see that you're the kind of people who are doing the right thing. So God made sure that they were intelligent, proficient in all writings and wisdom, and Daniel in particular had understanding of visions and dreams. So the this balance between external cooperation and internal resistance yields ultimate success on all fronts from God. And again, I think it's important to realize, or at least to emphasize, that Daniel never said, God doesn't allow us to do this, or God has told me I'm not allowed to do this. But once he resists, God steps in and says, you get the mada, haskel, you get the havana, b'chol chazon v'chalamot. That success, of course, comes from God. And then the last part of this perek, and the last theme that this chapter introduces, so it's not just that Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are successful. The last theme that this parak introduces is that that success has an effect on the king. The king notices that success. The king sees that success. And as we'll see in future stories, even more dramatically than in this one, the king takes note of the success of these kids. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, they are remarkably successful, and the king pays heed to that. So these are the five themes introduced in this first parak, introduced in this first story. As we'll see when we turn to the following stories, these themes are central to understanding the book as a whole. And therefore, here's the key point. This parak is not just chronologically the introduction to the book. It's not just meant to say, here's how Daniel got to the position in which he's going to be when we turn to parak bet. This isn't just a needed prologue in order to understand the fact of the coming stories. It's really a first story that clues us in to all of the important themes that the stories are going to be trying to teach over the coming six parakim. So this parak is clearly meant as an introduction. It's not just the first, it's actually an introduction, an overview, in a sense, of the important themes of the book. All right, so let me pause here. I see that there are comments in the chat. I'm going to open the chat. If Rabbi Kelman, if you have anything to say that people wrote to you, that would be fine. But otherwise, I'm going to take a couple of minutes to look at these and see if there's anything that that I can address quickly. Okay. I have to scroll up, apparently. Sorry.
The first question I have is Gershon, already addressed the one. That first question was addressed.
Okay, fantastic. Okay, so the meaning of the names. We do know the meanings. They're not Sumerian, they're Babylonian. We do know, we by which I mean, not me, and I guess from your question, not you. Know enough Babylonian to know the meanings of the names. Some of them are fairly straightforward. Aved Nego, for example, is the servant. Aved of presumably one of the Babylonian gods. His name is usually called Nabu, but the assumption is that that's a biform of that name. Belt Shatzar, also the Beleti is the Akkadian means mistress. In other words, the female form of Baal. So it's Daniel's name means may the lady protect the king. And as the short answer is that we do know the meanings of the names. Was Daniel originally a Kohen? There's nothing in the text that suggests so. I honestly can't say offhand whether there's anything in Chazal to say that he was or not. I don't know of anything offhand. Okay. Person doing the renaming have an effect on whether the renaming affects one's identity. Yeah, so I think that's a great point. I think Ashira's comment question I think highlights the fact that renaming tends to be, if it's effective, tends to be an expression of power and control. I can rename people whatever I want, but they're not going to listen to me. Only someone who's in control will actually be able to effectively rename. And so naming, bestowing a name or renaming, is absolutely symbolic of the fact that the renamer has power and control over the person that they're renamed. It's a good point about the... But I don't think Daniel has power, but he's clearly charismatic. They don't eat kosher food. Blesses them for it. Fantastic. Yes, I think we talked about that. So just a technical question. Is the verb for test the same used for Abraham and Akedah? So, I mean, the short answer is yes. This chapter is in Hebrew. So he uses the imperative form nas here, which is absolutely the same root as nisa used in the Akedah. How significant that is, I guess I'll leave for you to judge. I don't know. Yael asked, is this pre-Esther? So that's actually a great question. You can mean two different things by that question. In terms of the setting, this is absolutely pre-Esther. Esther takes place under the Persians, right? Ahasuerus, of course, is a Persian king. And that is, of course, after the Babylonian kingdom. So right now we're in the Babylonians. The Persians aren't going to come onto the scene for another few decades. In fact, by the time we get to the last of the stories of Daniel, the Persians will already be on the scene. So Daniel will sort of bridge us over to the Persian period. If you mean when was the book written, that's a harder question. That's harder to know. And for all sorts of reasons, including what I just mentioned, that the last of the stories comes from the Persian period. Most modern readers don't think that the book of Daniel was written in the Babylonian period, right? Written later on, but it's set earlier than Esther. So that's an important point. David's point that there's a Yosef parallel, he too was the wisest in the Egyptian court, is absolutely correct, and that is incredibly important. I don't think we have enough time to really dwell on this, but when we turn to Perek Bet, to chapter 2, which I plan to do only briefly, but I think you'll see those parallels even more sharply there. But as you said, he was the wisest in the Egyptian court. The Khartoumim are the ones who compete with him in both. And Daniel, like Yosef, will interpret the king's dreams. There's even more specific allusions as well. But again, I don't think we're going to have time to turn to that in a lot of detail. But you're absolutely right. That's really very important for understanding the character of Daniel. Okay. Let's see what else there is. How old were Daniel and his friends? It's a good question. We're told that they are youth. I think you have to imagine them as essentially adolescents. They're being trained to be wise people. They're not kids. They're not five-year-olds. It's a three-year education process. So, totally roughly imagine them from, let's say, 14 to 17 or 15 to 18 or something like that. They already have some basic education. They are now going to be trained to be young adults in the, what we would call young adults, in the court. Okay, so I think we're good. We're going to move on. Fantastic. All right, so that's the first chapter and hopefully introduction to some of the major themes that we're going to be seeing over the course of the coming stories. Okay, what you have in front of you now is a sort of outline of the book. There are 12 prakim, 12 chapters in the book overall. That's a little bit artificial. The last three are all one story. The first nine really do have independent headers, separate beginnings, and separate endings. But the last three are all one unit. We'll deal with it briefly, but we will look at 10 through 12 as a single unit. There's no breaks there. The chapter breaks, as I'm sure you all know, are medieval. They were for convenience sake, and sometimes it makes sense, sometimes not. I wouldn't worry too much about chapter breaks if they seem not to make sense to you. So there are really 10 units, 10 text units in the book. The first one, of course, we just dealt with. I put this up now both for sort of general orientation, so you can see where we're headed, and also to make a couple of points about what we're going to see. So one thing that we're going to see immediately is that about half of the book is actually not in Hebrew at all, but in Aramaic. And the Midrash mentions a couple of times, say things like, you should not take Aramaic lightly. Altehei Lashon Sursi Kal Be'enecha, because even in Tanakh, Aramaic is used, and they quote an example from Chumash. If everyone were unmuted, I would ask if remember where Aramaic is used in Chumash. Of course, it's with Lavan when he names the mound of stones Yigar Sahaduta, which Yaakov names Gal Eid in Hebrew. Then there's Aramaic in Nevi'im. There's one pasuk in Aramaic in Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu Parak Yud, he actually has one whole pasuk in Aramaic. And then Aramaic in Ketuvim, that's actually much easier. You have four prakim in Ezra and six prakim in Daniel, which are entirely Aramaic. So that's the first thing we're going to notice, is that half of this book is actually not in Hebrew at all. It's in Aramaic. As you see in the sort of chart that you have here, it's not entirely obvious why these six are in Aramaic and other things are in Hebrew. It is true that the following five stories, we're now going to have five narrative prakim. All of those are in Aramaic, but the next Perek Zayin, which is a vision, not a story, is also in Aramaic, and then the rest of the vision switch back to Hebrew. So the language doesn't exactly map onto genre, doesn't exactly map onto history, but about half the book is in Aramaic. And there's been a lot of speculation about why Aramaic. What does that mean? Is it an exilic? Is it a demonstration of being a diaspora Jew? Again, just by way of contrast, Esther is in Hebrew, of course, despite being written by the Jews in the Gola. Presumably could have been written in Aramaic, maybe even would have been better understood by the Jews in Shushan if it had been written in Aramaic. But presumably these choices are conscious. In other words, when a bilingual author sits down to write a book, they have to decide, are we going to write it in, which of the languages am I going to write it in? All right, so that's one point about the language. The second point is that the characters are, this is called the Book of Daniel. In the first parak, we saw that it's there's four characters introduced, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Daniel is going to be the main character for 90% of the following book. There's one parak Gimel, the fiery furnace, where Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are the main characters. Daniel will make a cameo in that parak, but that's basically a story about the three others. So I'm putting this here basically as a sort of lay of the land in terms of what we're about to see. Okay. Let me start with Perek Bet. Perek Bet we have, oh no, sorry, let me just see where I, oh yeah, fine, let me start with this, and I'll stick to the order of the slides, and hopefully it'll make sense the way I originally thought about it. Within the story, within the next six prakim, there is a fairly clear structure. So Perek Bet, which we'll turn to in a couple of minutes, is a dream that Nebuchadnezzar has, which turns out to be a dream, as Daniel explains it, of the four kingdoms. And I'll spend a little bit more time on that in a few minutes. But four kingdoms, meaning not just four kings, but four kingdoms, four eras in world history. Perek Gimel is a story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. They are going to resist an idolatrous decree of the king. They will not bow down to a statue that the king sets up. The punishment for not bowing down is that anyone who doesn't bow down gets tossed into a fiery furnace. They get tossed into the fiery furnace and they get, I hope this is not a spoiler, but they get miraculously saved by an angel. Perek Dalid, we go back to dreaming. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, slightly complicated, but of a tree that gets uprooted, and it turns out to be a dream of his own insanity. He's going to depart from Babel and eventually come back, again, as interpreted by Daniel. Perek Hay is the next king, Belshazzar. He's not exactly the next king, but a following king, Belshazzar, is very famous, writing on the wall. So at Belshazzar's feast, he sees writing on the wall. Only Daniel can interpret the writing on the wall for him. Perek Vav is a story of Daniel resisting. Here again, a royal decree. In this case, the decree is no one is allowed to pray to any other gods. Daniel resists and does pray to the God of Israel, prays in the direction of Yerushalayim. We'll talk more about that in a couple of minutes. The punishment for praying to any other god is to be tossed into the lion's den. He is tossed into the lion's den, and he's saved by an angel. Perek Zayin is a vision, not a story, and a vision of heaven that we'll, again, look at in a little bit more detail in a bit. And as it turns out, that vision tells Daniel about four kingdoms that are going to exist in world history. So the important thing is that it seems fairly clear that these prakim are organized in a chiastic structure. I'm guessing that you've already encountered the phrase chiastic structure. Basically, you know, A, B, C, C, B, A is what we have here. So the dream of Perek Bet, which turns out to be a dream of world history consisting of four kingdoms, matches the vision of Perek Zion, a vision that Daniel has in heaven, which also tells about four kingdoms. The story of Perek Gimel, where Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah violate the king's decree for religious reasons, are tossed into the Kibshan HaEsh, tossed into the fiery furnace, saved by an angel. That's mirrored by Perek Vav, where Daniel violates the king's decree to not pray and is tossed into the lion's den, where he's saved by an angel. And Perek Dalet and Perek Hay are actually not that closely parallel in the way that the others are, but they have a number of similarities as well. The reason I mention this is not because like it's cool, although I think it's interesting, but because I think it also suggests strongly that although Perek Zion is a vision, it's also to some extent the end of the stories. So when we think about the structure of the book, the first half through Perek Vav are narratives. The second half from Perek Zion through Yud Bet are visions. There's nothing happens in those other than Daniel has a vision, which tells him something very important. But Perek Zion is something of a pivot Perek. It is the first of the visions. It also concludes the unit of the stories. And I know that it concludes the unit of the stories because of this structure. It picks up on the themes of Perek Bet and concludes this chiastic structure of the first seven prakim of the book. Okay, so with that sort of broad overview of what we're going to see, I'm going to take these out of order. I just want to talk about a couple of them fairly briefly. Perek Hay. Perek Hay has a story. I don't have much of the text up here if you want to look at it inside, but I think it's a well-known story. Belshazzar, king after Nebuchadnezzar, was at a feast. This is the portrayal of Belshazzar by Rembrandt. And at the feast, he sees writing on the wall. He asks everyone to please read to him and interpret the writing on the wall, which he sees a hand writing, and he's terrified. No one else can read it and interpret it for him. The queen mother says, you know, there was once a wise man named Daniel in the court. He's around. He's just not at the banquet. Maybe we can invite him in. He comes in and he's able to read and interpret the writing on the wall. Now, as Daniel interprets it, the words say, Mene, Mene, Tekelu, Farsin, which are, you know, fairly common, you know, regular Aramaic words. Measured, weighed, and pieces or divisions. And Daniel then further comments that this means that you, Belshazzar, have been measured, weighed, found wanting, and therefore your kingdom is going to be broken up and divided. You can see in Rembrandt's picture what, according to Rembrandt, the problem was. In other words, Daniel's interpretation is not that complicated. If you read the words Mene Mene Tekel Farsin on the wall, these are, they could conceivably be coins, but they actually are regular Aramaic words, meaning weighed, measured, and divided. So what was the problem? Like, why couldn't anyone else read it and figure it out? What was the challenge here? So you can see in Rembrandt's picture that the hypothesis that he's following is that the letters were arranged vertically, right? So you see Mem Nun Aleph, Mem Nun Aleph, Taf Kuf Lamed, and so on. You know, that is in fact one of the views in the Gemara. There are four views in the Talmud as to what was going on. You see, this is following the view of Shmuel, who says that it said Mamtus Nankafi Aalran, which is what you get if you lay out the words vertically and then read them horizontally. So according to Shmuel, the problem is that all the other wise men were sitting at the feast, like trying to figure out what Mamtus Nankafi Aalran meant. They couldn't figure it out, it made no sense. So they were just stumped. And only Daniel said, oh, all you have to do is read down and you get normal Aramaic words. You see, there are three other opinions in the Gemara there. Rav said it was in Gematria. Rabbi Yochanan said each word was reversed. And Rabbi Ashi says that the first two letters of each word were reversed. A colleague of mine, Michael Siegel, who's at the Hebrew University, has a different suggestion, which I think is quite brilliant. His suggestion is that actually the problem is that no one else saw anything. Belshazzar saw writing on the wall, and he said, "What does that mean? What does that mean? Please, someone interpret that for me." And everyone else saw a blank wall. Only Belshazzar saw the writing on the wall, and that was what made Daniel's understanding so dramatically correct. Belshazzar had no doubts that Daniel was correct, because when Daniel came in, he said, "Well, it simply says, 'Menemenetz Kelepharsin,' that means you've been weighed, measured, and found wanting." Belshazzar said, "Well, that's exactly right. That's what I see as well. I didn't know what it meant, but I knew exactly what it said. I could see the letters." And the skill that Daniel had, so to speak, not a skill that could be learned in school, but was that only he and the king actually saw the writing on the wall. But this is the kind of thing I wanted to lead with this, both because I thought that was an important idea, but also because this is the kind of thing we see in these stories. Daniel has wisdom that can only be divine. And in that sense, I'm sorry, I don't remember, I think it was David who said that there's Yosef parallels here. This is absolutely correct. And that's a major theme of these stories, is that the king doesn't understand something. This is going to be in a couple of other stories as well. Daniel is brought in, and Daniel is able to insightfully understand what no one else could understand. And it's clear to everyone that this has to be divine. So I have to say, if Rembrandt was correct, Rembrandt's just following Shmuel, but if Shmuel were correct, the idea to read it vertically is not obviously supernatural wisdom. That's actually a fairly good idea that I suspect a lot of us actually might have come up with if we had to decipher this writing on the wall. And Siegel's understanding that actually only Daniel and the king saw the writing at all, I think that does a better job of capturing what made Daniel's wisdom so obviously impressive to the king, and that it was clearly supernatural. Yeah, he clearly had access to knowledge and wisdom that no one else had access to. All right, and we go back to Perek Bet, the first one. This story is similar in some ways to what we just saw in Perek Hay. Here, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and Nebuchadnezzar wakes up disturbed. Batipaim Rucho, the same phrase used with regard to Paro in Miketz. In other words, in the Yosef story, Nebuchadnezzar calls in all his wise men. And he said, "I dreamed a dream. Please tell me what I dreamed and what it meant. What I dreamt and what it meant, I guess." And the wise men all say, "That's not the way it's supposed to work. You tell us the dream, and then we tell you the interpretation." And Nebuchadnezzar says, "No, if I tell you the dream, you can make up an interpretation. That's not impressive. If you can tell me what I dreamt, then I'll believe your interpretation of the dream." And they can't do it. They've been trained in all sorts of arts, all sorts of intellectual pursuits, but they cannot tell what Nebuchadnezzar dreamed unless he tells them what the dream consisted of. So he says, "Well, I'm fed up with all these wise men. They're all frauds. I'm going to kill them all." And this includes Daniel and his friends. And Daniel gets wind of what's happened. He hears from others what's going on. And he says to someone in charge, he says, "Listen, let me have a shot at this." First, though, he offers a prayer. And this is very important. And in this regard, since you mentioned Yosef, I'll emphasize that this is different from Yosef. Yosef gives credit to God for his success, but never prays to God in Egypt. It's not something that we ever hear in Yosef's speech. But Daniel does. I'm sorry. So Daniel, in that sense, is a more impressive, overtly impressive Jew than Yosef is. He actually offers a long prayer to God. "So God, you're the one who knows all the secrets. You know all the razin. You reveal what you want to reveal. I need your help now. Please help me." He then goes to the king and he says, "Here's what you dreamed. You dreamed of a statue." And I don't know who the nonprofit is. You see on the bottom, there's copyright Todd Hampson. So I assume he's the nonprofit. But this is a nice sketch of the dream. A giant statue whose head is made of gold, torso made of silver, loins made of bronze, and then the bottom part made of iron mixed with clay. That's the statue that he dreams of. Then in the dream, a stone comes and smashes the statue. It's a small stone, it grows to be great. And Daniel explains that this refers to the four kingdoms in world history. The first one will be the Babylonian kingdom, Antu Resha de Dahava. You, Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold. then there's going to be, these are not named, these identifications are not in the text. Then there's going to be a silver kingdom, which succeeds the Babylonian kingdom, then a bronze kingdom, then a iron mixed with clay kingdom, and then that's going to be destroyed by a stone that's clearly miraculous, supernatural, because it's a small stone that destroys this whole statue that then grows to be a large stone and takes over the world. And this is, I think it's entirely fair to say this is a messianic vision. Messianic in a broad general sense, in the sense that it foresees the world unfolding four stages to world history, followed by a small stone that obviously represents, it doesn't have to be an individual, it could be Bnei Israel, but the return of Jewish sovereignty and a vision of the Jewish sovereignty taking over the world. This is not just, this is not Zionist. It might be also be Zionist, but it's not about the return of there being Jewish sovereignty. It's about sovereignty over the world being handed over to the Jewish people, to God's people. Now, I want to emphasize that this scheme is not new to Daniel. This scheme of the four kingdoms is actually an old idea. I think I put it here. Yeah. An old idea. This is a text from Hesiod, going back to about 700 BCE, a Greek author, in his Works and Days. And he says the world is divided into five broad eras. First is going back in the past. First, the golden race of mortal men. Then those who dwell on Olympus made a second generation of silver, less noble by far. Then a bronze race. Then a fourth one, which is not parallel to Daniel, which is actually better than the bronze race. And then a fifth one, a race of iron. That's us. That's the men. Never rest from labor, sorrow by day, perishing by night. God shall lay sore trouble upon them. So this idea that there's four kingdoms in the world, the four eras in the world, which are symbolized by four metals, gold, silver, bronze, iron, that is far older than Daniel. This goes back hundreds of years before that. And there are some parallels. So this is in Greece. There's some parallels in the Near East as well. And even in Persia, which is, I think, interesting. But of course, Daniel has modified it. First of all, this is going to the future, not the past. So unlike Hesiod's vision of this being the past, where we are the fourth, this is four kingdoms, gold, silver, bronze, and iron, iron and clay. And of course, the fifth is the most important for Daniel's vision. It's not to lead up to us and explain why we toil by day and die at night. We are the generation of iron. He says, but there's going to be a fifth, this stone, which is going to be supernatural, miraculous, and is going to return God's sovereignty to the world. So all these eras, the gold, the silver, the bronze, and the iron, they will be destroyed and superseded by the supernatural stone sent by God. So this is important. This happens often in Tanakh, that it turns out that there's a context here, right? That his audience, Daniel's audience, actually would say, like, yeah, we've heard about the gold, silver, bronze, iron. We've heard that before. And Daniel says, that's not the point, right? Nebuchadnezzar would be like, you're just telling me about the four eras of world history? I read that in Hesiod. And Daniel would say, no, you're missing the point here. Yes, there are four. That's true. We all agree with that. But of course, there's a fifth here. And that's the part that you and others haven't understood. There will be a return of divine sovereignty in the world. And that's what's in no one else's schemes. Later on, we'll talk a little bit about the echoes of Daniel in Jewish thought throughout the ages, just a bit. But there is, among the commentators, among the Mefarshim, among the Rishonim, on Daniel, there is a debate about how to understand the four kingdoms. So on this slide that Todd Hampson made, Rome is the fourth. And that is one view in the Rishonim, that these are the four kingdoms: Babylonia, Persia, Greece, and Rome. But someone like Abraham Ibn Ezra, who lived in Muslim Spain, says, well, that can't be right, because then, of course, you're missing the actual fifth kingdom. Here I am, I'm living in Muslim Spain. This scheme, if it ends with Rome, doesn't account for the Muslim conquests, which for him was half the world. At the time, it was half the world, half the known world anyway. This scheme would not include any prediction of the fact that there would be another kingdom that would actually take over much of Rome, take over, of course, the whole Middle East and North Africa and parts of Europe. Again, Ibn Ezra lives in Spain. So in Ibn Ezra's view, Greece and Rome is one kingdom. There's Babylonia, Persia, sort of Greco-Roman civilization, followed by the fifth one, which is the Empire of Islam. But of course, you know, none of these are easy to work out. And obviously, all of the Rishonim and Kal Vachomer us live in the sort of odd reality of saying, well, you know, the first few kingdoms went by relatively quickly, you know, half a century, maybe two centuries. This fifth one, this just keeps going on and on and on. And actually, there's a number of comments in the Rishonim on Perek Bet and Daniel reflecting on that, sort of commenting on the fact that we thought it would go by faster. We thought that this this stone that would end the fourth kingdom would have come by now, hasn't yet come, and yet we continue to wait in anticipation of it. Okay, let's, you know what, given the time anyway, let me pause here before I move on. So I see actually there's a lot in the chat, so I'm going to have to scroll up a bit. Yeah, okay. All right, so there's a couple of comments on back on the first chapter that I'm just going to not respond to now. If we have time at the end, we can go back to that. The languages. So could the language differences reflect different authors or times? That's a great question. Obviously, you know, the stories, except for Perek Aleph, are all in Aramaic. The visions are, except for Perek Zion, all in Hebrew. So they could reflect choices of, you know, different genres. Reflecting different authors of times would mean that Perek Aleph was written differently than Perek Bet through Vav. They seem to be united somehow, but of course they could have been joined together at some later point. So all I can say is that it's entirely possible. It's very hard to line up with any other intuitive hypothesis about the authorship here. Also, I just observe, but I'm really not going to pursue this here, that I guess I would have expected that Hebrew would be earlier than Aramaic. In other words, the longer the Jews live in Galut, the more they speak Aramaic. In this book, it turns out to be the opposite, that the stories, which are pretty much by all accounts earlier than the visions, are in Aramaic, and then the visions are in Hebrew. So it suggests that it's not simplistically time, but of course that may have something to do with it as well. Yeah, so good about the languages. Fantastic. Okay. So the fiery furnace, that's a great question. So Ruth asks, is this fiery furnace a source of the Midrash about Avram and his fiery furnace adventure? So that is a great question. I think the sort of obvious answer is yes. But it's hard to be 100% sure, and I'll mention a counterintuitive idea that some people have suggested. So just to remind the rest of you other than Ruth, there is a very similar story to the story of the fiery furnace in lots of Midrashim, and actually even before what we call Midrashim, before rabbinic literature, in Second Temple literature, about Avram. In other words, about Avraham before Lech Lecha, before Avraham is sent from Haran to Eretz Canaan. As I think everyone knows, there's a lot of stories about him, which to a large extent are necessary, because otherwise it seems entirely random that God chose this one guy, Avram, from Haran. So lots of stories about how Avram has proven his mettle before Lech Lecha. One very popular story, which has some very long versions of it, but I'm not going to dwell on it right now, involves Avram something about refusing to bow down to an idol and getting tossed into a fiery furnace for that reason, but being saved by God, by an angel, despite the sort of obvious death sentence that would have entailed. So that is obviously parallel to the story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah and Perakimel of Daniel. And yeah, I think as Ruth said, the sort of intuitive hypothesis is that here, as in many other cases, Chazal looked elsewhere in Tanakh to try to figure out what must have happened. And as they look, they have a problem in one part of Tanakh. So they say, well, you know, there's some similarity to another part of Tanakh. Over there, I know more about what happened. So I'm going to import those details of a story or even an entire story back to the first part of Tanakh as well. And it seems certainly intuitively compelling to think that that's what happened here as well, that the story from Daniel Parakimel was sort of transferred to Avram and developed there. if we had more time, or if this was a different topic, we could talk more about that, because it really takes on a whole life with Avram. I should say that there is a line later on in the stories of Avram when God says that I am God, Asher Otziticha Me'ur Kasdim, which is another problem, because by the accounts in Lech Lecha, God did not take Avram out of Ur Kasdim, he took him out of Haran. So the story of the fiery furnace allows an answer to that question by taking Ur Kasdim not to be a name of a place, Ur Kasdim, but Ur, the Aramaic fire. So I took you out of the fire of the Kasdim, the fire of the Babylonians. In other words, that's actually a reference to I saved you from the fiery furnace. So anyway, that's really fascinating. Lots of things to think about there. But I will mention that Yair Zakovich, who's used to be a professor at Hebrew University, actually reverses the hypothesis. He notices what Ruth noticed, that these stories are obviously parallel, but he also notices just how widespread the story of Avram and the fiery furnace is in Bayit Sheni literature and in Chazal. He says, this is not just like a midrash. This is like, everyone seems to know the story of Avram and the fiery furnace. I wonder if, he says, I wonder if that story is actually so old that actually Jews back in Bayit Rishon knew that story. They knew the story of Avram and the fiery furnace. And he actually speculates that the story of Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah was influenced by the oral stories of Avram that had circulated back even before Churban Bayit Rishon, but were never put into writing. We only have them in writing centuries, like a millennium later, but he thinks that that actually the story of Avram might even be earlier than the stories of Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah. But I mentioned that because, first of all, it's just fascinating, and it highlights the fact that Midrashim, we tend to think of as Midrashim, and, you know, as... in my field, we do this all the time, to think of, like, this is how Chazal understood this. But some of these midrashim may, in fact, be oral stories. I don't want to say that they go back to the time of Avram, but they may, in fact, go back a millennium before Chazal. And they may have circulated even before the book of Daniel, and the relationship would then be the other way around. Okay. So I should just clarify. Daniel's name is Belteshazzar, and the king is Belshazzar. So slightly, someone actually said that. Great, fantastic. Great. I think Rembrandt was just writing the Nun Sofit in the middle. I think it's just not completed, but I don't know, you can look again later more carefully if you want. Rembrandt, as you know, actually lived on the same block as Menashe ben Yisrael. Like he had some Jewish informants when he needed to know Hebrew and Aramaic. So it's possible that he painted it wrong, but I think he was just painting a short Nun Sofit that's still in the middle. Okay, I'm skipping some of the comments, which are great, but I'm not going to try to respond to everything. Yes, that's a good important point. Okay, fantastic. So just, great discussion about Ibn Ezra. If I said that he wrote in Muslim Spain, I don't think I said that, but if I said that, I misspoke. As someone said, he wrote in Christian Europe. All of his commentaries are written. He travels to Fez, but basically in Christian Europe, but he grows up. His first 50 years of his life are in Muslim Spain. And that obviously profoundly affects the way he thinks about world history. So, okay, we'll leave it at that. So we're going to turn now to the last section, which is, as I said, different generically, and as the genre is different, and more challenging. So Perek Zion, I want to look at for a couple minutes. It's really a tough perek, not in terms of the words, but the ideas are really challenging in all sorts of ways. So as we mentioned, the actual interpretation, the content, will eventually get to there being four kingdoms in the world, taking its cue from Perek Bet. But before he gets there, Daniel says that he saw a vision, and you see here on the slide in front of you, there were four Chevan Rav Revan, Salkan Min Yama, Shanyan Dat Min Da. So there were four great beasts, Rav Revan Chayot, that were coming out from the sea. Each one was different. The first was like a lion, but had eagle's wings. The wings were plucked off. It was lifted from the ground, sat on its feet like a man, given the mind of a man. Second, like a bear, but raised on one side, with three fangs in its mouth among its teeth. A and it was told, Kumi, Achuli Besar Sagi, get up and eat a lot of meat. And then there was another one like a leopard, a Namar, which had wings on its back. And the beast had four heads, and Shultan Yehiv La, and dominion, Shultan, was given to it. So there are these four beasts, which are obviously strange. And then that was a three beast. And then the fourth one, which is, as you see, Dechila V'Takifa Yatira. This is exceedingly fearsome and dreadful. We had teeth of iron, devoured and crushed, stamped the remains with its feet. It was different from all the other beasts which had gone before. It had 10 horns. And as he's looking at these 10 horns, a new little horn sprouted up among them. Three of the older horns were uprooted to make room for it. There were eyes in this horn like those of a man, and a mouth that spoke arrogantly. So that vision we'll come back to in a minute. I'll try to say something about what Daniel says it means. But then it gets theologically weirder. This is weird anyway, but theologically, then it gets even stranger. Because then he looks on more, and he sees thrones set in place. Right, that's Karsavan. And Atik Yomin Yitiv, Levushe Kitlag Chivar, Usare She Kamar Nike, Karsaye Shivivindi Nur Galgilohi Nur Dalik. So an old ancient man, garment like white snow, hair like lamb's wool, throne was tongues of flame, wheels were blazing fire. And you probably recall from Yechezkel that Yechezkel also sees God sitting on a throne that has wheels. And a river of stream comes from him. Elef alfin isham shunei, thousands upon thousands serve him. Ribo rivavan kadamohi, myriads upon myriads attending him. And there are books open. Yikumun dina yitiv v'sifrin petichu. This is the only biblical reference to there being books open in heaven, which of course we're going to spend a lot of time thinking about and talking about in a few weeks. And as he's looking on at this Atik Yomin, this ancient one, Chazeh Havet B'Chazveh Lelia, and look, there comes one like a human riding on the clouds of heaven. He reaches the Atik Yomin, Atik Yomaya, and was presented to him. And he gets Shultan V'Ikar U'Malchu, and everyone worships, apparently appropriately, this human-like figure. So I suppose it'll sort of be not at all surprising to find out that this vision is cited often in early Christian literature, because it very much sounds like there's God, the Atik Yomin, sitting in heaven, and then there's a human-like figure who is presented to him, and he gets everlasting dominion that shall not pass away, and his kingship, one that shall not be destroyed. So that's what I meant by this is theologically challenging. This is mentioned in the Gemara in Chagiga, where the heresy of saying Shtei Rashuyot Bashamayim is mentioned as well. In other words, if it occurs to someone to say that there are two powers in heaven, so of course the Gemara says that's heretical. I don't think that's a subtle theological point in Judaism, but this chapter does seem to this vision does seem to challenge that to a large extent. There is a human like figure who gets dominion from God, and again that dominion is not temporary. It's Shultan Olam Dila Ye'edei Malchutei Dila Titchabal. Now, interestingly, not surprisingly, I suppose. Daniel is like very disturbed by this. He says, I don't understand what's happening here. What's going on here? And the angel then explains to him what has happened. And the vision is then, I would say, the word is used in the parak, but theologically defanged. So the four animals refer to the four kingdoms, that we already talked about. In other words, which in parak bet were the gold, silver, bronze, iron/clay. Here they're symbolized by four animals. And the human-like figure here is, again, God's kingdom on earth, which may or may not sound Christian to you, but is meant to be God's chosen people. So in the end of Perek Zayin, I didn't include the Psukim on the slides, sorry, but the end of Perek Zayin, it's quite explicit that this is not Shtei Rashi Rupa Shamayim. It's not two heavenly powers that divide power somehow. But God, who gives power to Bnei Yisrael on earth, he will in the distant future. But the vision itself is really, seems more dramatic than the interpretation that's given to it, but the interpretation is right there in Perek Zayin. But this chapter is certainly quite fascinating and as I say, I think challenging and disturbing is not too strong a word on a number of levels as well. Some of the specific interpretations, specific points, which we just don't have time to dwell on, but things like here in the pasuk that the fourth beast has 10 horns and then a little horn sprouts, 3 horns have to be uprooted to make room for it. So some of these have fairly specific interpretations later on in history, and that modern scholars have identified in historical narratives, in particular about the Seleucid, the Syrian Greek Empire that we know of primarily from the story of Hanukkah. And that is something that we'll turn to right now. I didn't actually put the text in here, did I? No. All right, so I'm sorry, I didn't put the text in. If anyone wants to look at it, you can look at it. But what I'm going to turn to now is chapter 9, Perek Tet. Perek Tet is actually really fascinating. I probably should have included at least the beginning here, because Perek Tet is one of the first explicit cases of someone in Tanakh actually reading Tanakh and interpreting it. So in this case, it's Daniel saying that he's sitting in Galut and reading Yirmiyahu. And Yirmiyahu, as you probably recall from Yirmiyahu, a couple of times in Perek Kaf Zayin and in Perek Kaf Tet in 27 and 29, says that God is giving dominion to the Babylonians, and that's going to last 70 years. And Daniel is now sitting in Babylonia, and he says, it's been 70 years. Like, what's going on here? It's not happening. Like, why is the 70 years not coming true? So he prays for understanding, prays for insight. And after a 20 pasuk prayer, he is graced with a visit from an angel who says, before you even started your prayer, I set out to enlighten you. Here's what it means. The 70 years does not mean 70 years. It means 70 weeks of years. And we don't have a lot of time to work through the details. It's not that long, so you can certainly read through fairly quickly. But he says the first 7 weeks are going to be one thing. Then there's going to be 62 weeks of something else, followed by one last week. A week, as it's used in the Torah, of course, means 7 years. So 70 weeks of years now means it's 490 years. So this is, of course, a fairly traumatic. If you thought that the exile was going to end after 70 years, you were just sort of waiting, like maybe I miscalculated, it's now 73, to be told that actually it's 490, that's a big deal. Now, working out this arithmetic and trying to figure out what the 490 refers to has been occupying readers, interpreters, Jewish and others, for many centuries at this point. It seems fairly clear that at least to some extent, the last week finds its fulfillment in the story of Hanukkah. And this is important for thinking about the historical context of the book. The last 7 years, it says in Daniel Perek Tet, says the last 7 years are going to be divided in half. And for half a week, he, this bad person who will kill someone else, is going to stop the korbanot. I put the English here, for half a week, he will put a stop to the sacrifice and the meal offering, the korban and the mincha. So that matches pretty well the 7 years leading up to what we celebrate on Hanukkah. In other words, starting from, let's say, 171, which is a possible day for the murder of Chonio. The story is told in 2 Maccabees. I don't have time to remind you of it right now. Who was a Kohen Tzaddik. And then halfway through, starting in 167, when the decrees of Antiochus come through, that's when there are no more korbanot. And roughly about 3.5 years later is when there's Chanukat HaMikdash, the Hashmonaim are victorious. And you can certainly see that as the end of the 490 years. So this is important. I'm sorry that I don't have time to think more with you about this this morning, but this is quite important in thinking about what exile means and what Geula means. The conventional view in Tanakh and later Jewish history was that the 70 years ended with the Geula, of return to Tzion, Shivat Tzion, led by Shesh Batzar and Zerubbabel, and Bayit Sheni. Once there's another Beit HaMikdash, that seems to be a Geula. But Daniel here in Perek Tet is rejecting that, actually, and saying, that's not a Geula. Like, if most of us are still here in Babel, most of us here are, you know, sitting on, he's sitting at the Nahar, the Uval River, off in modern Iran, and he's trying to figure out, like, where Geula is, and that's not a Geula. Geula has to be the restoration of Jewish sovereignty over the land of Israel. And that didn't happen under the Persians. When the second Beit HaMikdash was built and dedicated, it was still in the Persian Empire. That only happens in 164 BCE with the Hashmonaim. So I think there's a lot to think about there, but unfortunately I'll have to just sort of leave that on the table for you to think more about. That 490, I'm just going to say a couple of things very quickly and then leave a few minutes for the last comments and questions. That 490 is the first of a series of numbers that are offered in the book of Daniel for when the Geula will take place. Actually, back in Perek Zion, he said, Idan, Idan, Uplag Idan, so which could be taken as meaning time, I'm sorry, Idan, Idanin, Uplag Idan, time, times, and half a time, so maybe that means three and a half. Then he gets four, which no one knows what it means exactly. Then you get 490 in Perek Tet. Then in Perek Chet, you had the number 1,115 days. And then in Perek Yudbet, we get two numbers, 1,290 days or years, and 1,335 days or years. Those are in back-to-back psukim. Decoding these numbers, trying to figure out what they might refer to, has been a whole cottage industry. There's actually an old book by Joseph Sarachek from like the 1930s on something called like Messianic Calculations Among the Jews or something like that, where he collects dozens and dozens of views in the Rishonim and others, trying to figure out what these numbers mean. I put up here just heuristically, Sefer HaGeula, by the Ramban, Al Inyanei HaGeula HaAtida, where he starts Hashara Shlishiyah Sefer Zeru Tanila Mar Sefer Daniel Nitparish Bo Be'er Hetev Inyan Bayit Sheni V'Chama Shanim Ya'amod K'sheyachrav Acharechem. So he says, oh, Book of Daniel, that explains really well the future history of the second Beit HaMikdash and how long it's going to stand and what's going to happen after it. So Ramban actually spends the third part of his book, Sefer HaGeula, trying to decode these numbers. His own predictions have long passed. I mean, this is sort of true about almost all messianic predictions, is that, you know, it turns out that they're not that long after the person making the prediction, and the Ramban is no different. He predicts something that's now about 600 years in the past. So the numbers are, I suppose, yet to be decoded. The last two things I'll mention very, very quickly. One is that the very last perek of Daniel, Perek Yudbet, contains the only explicit prophecy of Tchiyat HaMitim in Tanakh. There are predecessors, which we don't have time to talk about now, in Yeshayahu and in Yechezkel, but the only time you have, this is Perek Yudbet Pasuk Bet, Rabim Mishinei Admat Afar Yakitsu, Eile L'chaye Olam, Ve'eile L'charafot L'dir'on Olam. That prophecy that in the future, many dead people will awaken, some to Chaye Olam, other to eternal shame, that's here for the first time. And that's obviously a crucially important idea for Jewish thought. On the far more trivial side, the second to last line in the book, Vata lich laketz v'tanuach v'ta'amod l'gorolcha laketz hayamin, at the end of days, you notice that yamin here is with a nun sofit rather than mem sofit. That's pretty standard in Second Temple Hebrew, Bayit Sheni Hebrew, that final mem and nun interchange, the Mishnah is all over the place. But in many versions of Yigdal, we have the line, Yishlach haketzi yamin mishichenu, liftot mecha keketzi shoto. Other sidurim have yamim there. And I don't know which one's original because we don't have this guy's manuscript. But anyway, if it says haketzi yamin, that's clearly drawn from this phrase in Daniel. Even if it says haketzi yamim, it's drawn from Daniel, just sort of normalized to a final mem rather than a final nun. But this line, which is the second, the 12th of the Ikarei Emunah in Yigdal, that Yishlach HaKetzi Amin Mishichenu, Atot Mecha HaKetzi Shuato, followed by Metim Yichaya El Baruch Haso, Tchayat HaMetim, that's also an allusion to Daniel Perek Yudbet, and the end of the Perek there. Okay, so I'm sorry for taking more time than I had hoped. But let me stop here. We have a few more minutes. So let me see what else we have. God does not. So a number of people asked or commented on the fact that Daniel is or is not a Navi. So this is actually a very great question. It comes up in the Rishonim and in the Gemara in Megillah, the very beginning of Masach Megillah, whether Daniel is or is not among the Nevi'im. I mean, he's not, as you know, literally. I don't remember who earlier said, I think it's Meiri's view, which I think is quite good, that Daniel is never said to speak to anyone else. He gets visions from God, but unlike other Nevi'im, he's never told, go tell other people. Actually, on the contrary, Daniel is told, wrap it up, seal it up, and this is only for your benefit. Of course, there's an irony there because we're reading it. So obviously he didn't seal it up, or he did, but literally. But that might be, in fact, an important question in terms of thinking about what makes a Navi. It's not only insight into God, but also a job. Insight into God and the job of conveying that to other people. But there's a lot of, there are a bunch of other opinions, and I guess we'll have to leave it for another time. Okay. Timing. 7 weeks of years, the timing is even worse according to... Right. No, it's true. 490 is not going to work out well. That is absolutely, absolutely true. It's hard to know, as I think, you know, as you know from Seder Olam, from Chazal, later Jews had a really rough idea of how long the Persian period lasted. It takes... As we have pretty specific ideas of it, which we get essentially from Greek historians. And it was because we have Herodotus, we know exactly how long Xerxes reigns, exactly how long Artaxerxes reigns, and so on and so forth. Archaeology is not great, and we don't have anything like Sefer Melachim. So when you think about Sefer Melachim, it gives us a framework for the history of Bayit Rishon. We have no comparable book in Tanakh for Bayit Sheni, and therefore... Jews who weren't reading Herodotus actually do have a much harder time figuring out the exact number of years in Bayit Sheni. And, you know, that's a whole sugya unto itself. Okay, if I have a second, I'll say this about the Apocrypha. Okay, fine. So I just, since I think that's the last one, I'll just say very quickly, yeah, it's a great point. There are other stories of Daniel that circulated in Bayit Sheni. There are stories that you can look up. They're in other people's Bibles. So the Apocrypha is in the Catholic Bible, Ad Hayom Hazeh. It was in the Christian Bible until Luther. Luther noticed that they weren't in the Hebrew Bible and he took them out. So now they're not in the Protestant Bible, they are in the Catholic Bible. But if you Google Susanna or Baal and the Dragon, these are both stories about Daniel that are ancient. These are Jewish stories about Daniel. We don't have any way of saying they come from Daniel's time or they come from 200 years later or they come from 400 years later. There's just no way of knowing. But Jews during Bayit Sheni told other stories about Daniel, which are quite interesting. And they are in other versions of the book of Daniel, but not the Jewish version of the book of Daniel. Why that is a tough question. It's really hard to know. There are some halachically odd things in the book of Susanna, for example, like maybe that's why, but very hard to be sure of such things. And they're great stories. So I would certainly say they're worth reading. They're both, you know, short stories. And I'll just say that Daniel in the Dead Sea Scrolls is a major figure. I don't remember the number, but lots of copies of Sefer Daniel. It's actually quoted a couple of times and some of other references to the figure of Daniel. So he is a really central figure in Bayit Sheni Judaism. He's still, I think, a central figure in Judaism, but his role has always been sort of vague. And I think that relates to something, you know, we just talked about 2 minutes ago. He's a Navi with, you know, divine messages, but never conveying them. And in fact, on the contrary, many of them are very enigmatic, sealed up in these mysterious numbers, and therefore very important, but very hard to say Daniel said X, Y, or Z. And that's especially with regard to the visions. The stories, of course, have, you know, lived long. I mean, these are famous stories, I think. They've transcended Jewish culture. The writing on the wall is a phrase in English. The Four Kingdoms, I think, is a very famous story. And the Lion's Den, again, these are well-known stories. And Daniel certainly repays the attention that we give it. All right, So thank you for your time. Are we coming? I'm sorry for
No, no. What do you mean? You're 1 minute. We go to 12:15. That's what, thank you very much. And like people wrote, a very, very difficult book. And really, you put it in perspective, the main themes and an overview of the book. Really, yeah, Yasher Koch, thank